This is a Collider.com audio interview.
I have to ask, what's the piece of paper? What?
This is the state of Oklahoma in reverse.
That is?
It is.
There you go.
It's also who's in this room, I think.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So, now, let's talk about Mad Men. Yeah, I'm going to record this, too.
And let's talk sideburns. They look great on you.
I like yours, too.
Thank you. Are you digging them? Do you like them? Or as soon as
I had them before the season.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So no story there.
There's no story. Sorry. Next.
We do hear that the wardrobe for the men is going to be particularly interesting this season. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I wish I could.
You're not really allowed to say anything.
So, I love the fact that you were named after Vincent Van Gogh in your official bio.
I'm actually not. No, my official bio is the wrongest thing you've ever seen in your entire life.
Do you plan to fix that?
I've tried endlessly. I've gotten down on my knees and blown the entire staff of IMDb, which is 35 people and 2 dogs. And I actually didn't have to do the dogs. I was just...
Maybe next time, hopefully.
No, I can't get it changed. For the rest of my life, people will be asking me why I studied history at UCLA when I dropped out of high school when I was 15 years old.
Why did you drop out of high school?
Why? I wanted to go make money. You know.
Yeah. So can you talk a little bit about what it is about Pete that you relate to, that you identify with?
Sure, absolutely. I think we have some similarities. We are both insecure. We're both feel unworthy. We both have moments of immaturity. We can both be impulsive. And we're both unlikable types.
Do you think he sees Don as kind of a father figure and he really wants his approval?
No.
No?
No, but I think he might have at one point, yes. But no, not anymore.
I was actually thinking along those lines, not to talk about what happens in the new season, but Pete does seem to get a great sense of enjoyment whenever he gets a chance to like get one over on Don or prove Don wrong in some way.
Well, sure, but I think that's true. He probably feels that way about everybody, right? I think he gets that enjoyment whenever he can do that. But yeah, with Don, who's kind of the big dog on campus, it probably feels a little bit better. But now that they've been working together for, you know, years and years and years, I think that some of those feelings of, you know, it's like when you first start working with a big celebrity, at first you're like, oh, wow, I revere everything they say. And then, you know, 6 months into the job, you're kind of like, oh, that guy, yeah. Because you see behind the curtain and you kind of know that Oz is just a man. He's not really a wizard. And, you know, it's, that's kind of what's happened. He's seen that the great and powerful Don Draper is really the weak and scared Dick Whitman. And, as much as he wanted his approval, now he's gotten to a point where he's just trying to manage him and make sure the jobs come in on time and that the clients don't see exactly that he's not a wizard.
Right.
And that's the real challenge for Pete. Is keeping, you know, I'm saying too much.
Now that he's getting an apartment in the city, do you think that he'll be able to indulge in his worst instincts?
That's hard to say.
Talk a little bit about it. Talk a little bit about how much you've known going into each season. How much is
nothing?
Really, Matthew's
nothing.
Never said anything.
Nothing.
So
nothing.
Talk a little bit about your reaction to last season, the way how it all played out. Were you like, is, you know what I mean? Like, because it's basically a year later, you get to talk about what happened.
Right.
So, were there any twists and turns last season that you were like, well, what was one that really got you?
You know, I was surprised by the whole Joan thing, but I understood it, you know, and it was explained to me. I enjoyed very much the storyline with Beth Dawes. I mean, Matt told me about 3 episodes in, he was like, you're looking for your mistress. You're looking for your girl on the side. You're looking for someone who will love you. Because he had success. He was a partner. He was the boss man at work. Everyone was listening to him. But he didn't feel loved. His wife was getting everything her way, and the child was getting a lot of love, but he didn't feel loved. So he wanted that. And he found love with this woman who they shared this sadness, this unconsolable sadness, this broken child sadness that some people go through life feeling. And most people don't, especially back then, don't have any pity for people like that. They don't care. Oh, you're sad. Oh, poor Pete Campbell. No. But this girl did care. She understood. Or at least she could relate. And he felt he had a kindred spirit. And then that was taken away. And so he had this awareness about himself that he would never be happy. He would never be content. He would always be an open wound. And I love that. I love that speech, and I love that idea. And I think it's very true, and I think it's part of the human condition. And we'll see how Pete reacts to it. We'll see if it helps him in his life at all.
Did you actually hear from people after Pete did what he did to Joan, sort of pushed her in that direction? Did you hear from people saying, I mean, Pete's done so many sort of slimy, sleazy things throughout the season, but specifically after that episode?
Well, people love Joan.
Right. Right, that's what I mean. Right.
You know, you can step on the neck of a lot of people, but right. You don't want to step on the neck of Joan. Because the world out there enjoys that character. And so people had a higher level of protectiveness around that. But I think it's quite funny because everyone says that's the worst thing Pete's ever done, and I think, what did he do? Isn't that the worst thing Joan's ever done on the show? Because all he did was offer her 5% of the company to go on a date with this guy. She's the one who said yeah. And I understand
he sort of
that
lied to the
makes him a pimp.
Partners about he sort of lied.
How's that?
To Don. Well, because he sort of cut Don out of the conversation to not even sort of.
No, Don was in the conversation, but then Don left before they voted.
Right.
And he looked at all the other partners and said, we're all partners. It's four partners in this room, and that's one that left. 4-1, it's a democratic society. And the other three guys looked at him and said, okay, if she says yes, but I don't want to do it. And Pete said, well, this company needs a car. This agency needs a car. And let's be honest, Joan's not a nun. It's not like Joan got to where she got to because of her great secretarial skills. You know, I mean, she was an element that they had in the office for the reason that when clients came, she walked them through the office. I mean, that's the flat truth of it. She was sleeping with one of the partners for years. She'd slept with other people at the job site. They had referenced that she had slept with Michael Gladys' character in the pilot. She was a known, you know, he brought it to her because he thought she'd say yeah. And they offered her more than they probably needed to because they respected. They respected her. And she was a good secretary, but that's not the element that put her in the office. But what's interesting is how people react not only to what happened, but to my comments afterwards. And, you know, people people like characters like Don Draper over Pete Campbell, even though Don Draper's done just as many terrible things as Pete Campbell. But the reason that we like Don Draper and Joan Harris and not Pete Campbell is because Don Draper and Joan Harris are attractive and they're charming and they're subtle and they're well-dressed and they're poised and they keep their cool. And we like to imagine that we're like that too. That we're really good-looking and everybody likes us and wants to be us. But they don't. Most of us are kind of ugly. And most of us aren't very charming and lose our cools all the time and act like fools. And we hate ourselves for that. So we like to look at the TV screen hate the guy on the TV screen so that we don't have to hate ourselves. That's my theory.
Right.
He's like, you're right. But I think it's an interesting thing about society, the way that they judge some characters and the way that they refuse to... I mean, what if Joan Harris had come to Pete Campbell and said, Pete Campbell, will you sleep with this person? And Pete Campbell's like, I will. I guarantee you, people would be saying it's Pete Campbell. And I know it sounds crazy to you, but I almost guarantee that that's the way it would go. And it's partly because of the writing. It's written in the sense that Don Draper's your protagonist, and you're supposed to follow that story, and that's good that we do. But I also think it's an interesting statement about society, that we are prone to just be that shallow. And I'm the same way. We are shallow enough to be like, oh, but Roger Sterling is great. He is a charmer, isn't he? Even though he's cheating on his wife at any chance and, like, doing all these despicable, terrible things and riding girls around the office like a horse. But, oh, he's so funny! So we excuse it all. Whereas Pete Campbell's not funny. So it's not excusable. Because he's not charming. And if you... It's like presidents or rock stars. You know, JFK could have sex with anyone he wanted and... Bill Clinton and you know, because they're charming and they're witty. And that lets you get away with a lot.
So do you think there's something wrong with people who, for Pete's their favorite character?
No. I don't think there's something wrong with people for that, no. I mean, I think everyone's different and I'm making big generalizations, but I think some people have reasons for liking or disliking characters, and who knows what an individual's reasons are, but maybe those people are just aware of what's maybe driving him, or maybe they feel sympathy for him. I feel very sorry for him, and I feel very sorry for myself, so it's easy to feel sorry for him. And especially back then, the world just didn't have pity for guys like that. But I do, and I'm the kind of guy who's like, I see someone who's like, everybody hates, and I'm like, oh, I want to be their friend. You know, like, nobody likes this guy. What's so wrong with him? And then usually I'm like, oh, yeah, he's an asshole. and it, you know, but I'm still drawn to it. So maybe that it's just people like that, they want to save somebody.
And you also get some of the most hysterical lines in the show.
They're not meant to be funny. They're really not.
If you could give me advice, what kind of advice would you give him?
Don't lose your cool. You know, when you lose your control, when you lose your cool. I saw a guy in the airport last week, and he was yelling at these people. You lost my bag. There was $70,000 worth of camera equipment. And I kept thinking, man, these people are losing so much respect for you. Like, you're never going to get anything accomplished that way. Now, if you stay calm, you'll terrify the shit out of them. Because they're like, oh, fuck, this guy's just calm and collected. And as long as you're just calm and collected, you have a lot of power in a situation.
Kindness.
It's not kindness. It's calmness. You don't have to be kind. You have to be calm. Because once you start showing that they can affect your emotions... then you obviously don't have that much power. If a stewardess can affect your emotional life, then you don't have any power in life, and you just showed your whole hand.
If you could go back to when you first started doing Mad Men, is there any like advice or anything you tell yourself back then that you sort of learned along the way in terms of anything from the way the show's run to the way it's written to interactions, anything like that? Anything you've learned?
Sure, there's things I've learned, but I wouldn't take any of it back. I mean, I wouldn't tell myself anything, no. I mean, that's one of those hard questions to answer because it's like, I'm still alive right now. So if you could go back into the past and tell yourself something, wouldn't you be terrified that, like, you're going to tell yourself something and then, like, because of that, you're going to have an extra beer one night and on the way home, some guy's going to sideswipe you and you're going to die? Like, I am still alive! I don't want anything to change! Okay? I'm alive. I'm very happy. I'm still on the show. Pete Campbell's still alive. You know, like, I'm not going to fuck with it, okay?
It's good. Time travel shows.
No, man, I'm just serious. Like, I'm just a believer in serendipity.
I have to say, last season I was very worried for Pete Campbell's fate. So I felt like they were obviously building up to somebody dying.
I know.
And they were beating up on you a lot all season.
I know,
but
yeah.
How worried were you?
Not at all. Matt told me I was safe.
Oh.
Will you just be quiet? I'm so serious. Like, these guys are being all patient.
Yeah.
No, I'm just teasing.
I'm just waiting to jump in at that last moment.
I'm just teasing.
The show immerses you in the culture of the 60s.
Mm.
So is there anything about it that you love? The music, the fashion, the women treat women?
Yeah. I guess it was horrible. Was it horrible?
I lived it, yeah.
What was the horriblest thing about it?
That women were expected to be second-class citizens.
They were. How's that?
Because you would get married and you would take your husband's name and everything he said would go, and that's
right.
Why
right.
I never got married.
Right. No, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense, you know. But I do find it interesting. I have four sisters, and I do find it interesting because my sisters were all born in the 70s, and my mom raised them and was like, "You're gonna have a job. You're gonna have a career. You're gonna be successful, and it's gonna be great." And now my sisters are in their 40s, and they're all like, "I just want a husband, and I just want to make him dinner, and I just want him to come home, and I just want to be. I don't want to go to work and work." In corporate America, and there's not enough jobs for everybody. And I mean, you know, I think there's a certain segment of the female population that doesn't really want that. Now, I'm glad that it's been liberated and that there's many more opportunities and more women are going to school, and that's great. And I think education is the number one priority. But I also think that, you know, second class citizens is strong. That's strong.
Well, I mean, I was raised in a household where the man's word was law.
But that still is the case in a lot of households.
Well,
you know what I mean? And it wasn't the case in all households back then. And there was a lot of homes. I mean, I know in my grandparents' homes, my grandma ran the home. You know, so when he was at the office, he ran the office, and she ran everything at the home.
Okay, but when he came home, did she make him believe that things were his decision?
Well, I wouldn't know, but I would know. I do know that every time I saw him with her, the only thing I ever heard him say was "Yes, dear." You know, like it was basically like "Yes, dear, I understand you. Let me go onto the roof and shovel the ice off." Now, every family is different, and every situation is different, and I think. Definitely, there were a lot of things in the 1960s that it's wonderful that they're not anymore. I mean, I think especially in the workplace, things have really gotten a lot better. But I think that if I could go back to the 60s, I wouldn't like the element of the way women are treated. That wouldn't be the thing that I like the most. I think probably the music and... Yeah, the music was good, and I think that whole idea that things could change. Because, you know, the good thing is that women felt a specific way, and they'd felt that way for hundreds and hundreds of years, and things changed. You know, so it wasn't like the 60s came and then everyone became a second-class citizen. It was like they were second-class citizens for a long time, and then in the 60s they were like, we're going to change some things. And I think the thing that that's bothersome about now is that things don't change really. You know, that there's not really movement. We have Occupy Wall Street, and then after like 2 years, everyone's just like, "All right, well, that's over with." But like, nothing fucking changed. Like, right? You know, so at least things did change. You know, at least
there was an era when you felt that there was hope that you could change things.
Yeah, and people gathered together. And maybe it's because it was like the civil rights movement was such a large portion of the population, and the movement for women's liberation was such a large portion of the population that was kind of, once they all got on board with it, it was like, whoa, okay, that's a lot of people to fight. Whereas Occupy Wall Street, not enough people really got on board, you know? So maybe that's the thing. But yeah.
What kind of father do you think people be?
That's hard to say.
Will it be a good thing for him or not so good?
That's also hard to say.
Okay.
Well, do you think he could look at his father and say, "I don't want to do that"?
I think he would say that. But I think that's oftentimes a problem with raising kids. Because you say, "I don't want to do what my dad does," so you go so polar opposite. You know, mm-hmm. It's like if you were raised in a home where there was lots of discipline, then you let your kids have everything. You know, and I think... that could work against him if he does that. You know, if he's like, my father didn't love me at all, so I'm going to smother this child with love. That's not always the best thing either, you know. What do I know about having kids?
Talk a little bit about your the preparation process for the show. Are you typically, like, do you follow a set schedule where you are, you know, breaking down the script as soon as you get it? Are you breaking down the scenes you have the night before to memorize? Just, I'm just curious how you prepare for each episode.
Oh, well, I'm in character now. I stay in character throughout the season now. We get the episode a day before we start shooting. I read it again. We go to the table read. I get notes from Matt. I write them down. I go home. I look at my order of scenes. The day before my scene, I read it over. If I have a lot of stuff to do, I'll read it over a few times. I'll run it with a specific person who cannot be named. And I will work on it sometimes. Sometimes it's the kind of scene where I don't want to work on it very much because I want to stay open for what happens on the day. And then I go into work, and then I shoot, and then I go home, and then I take a bath, and then I dry my hair, and then I take a poop, so I have to take another bath. No, that's all. Well, I'm sorry, yes, I shit, okay? Newsflash. Here come the questions.
Now when you shit... Is it usually fun?
Now he chimes in.
Yeah, I found something I cared about. So.
There you go. The good stuff.
I do want to ask, so you've shown a great knowledge of this time. Even the shit. Did you do immediate research once you got the role? Or is this just sort of something that's come along that you really have this... You really have a deep understanding of that time period. You certainly have discussed and argued here.
I know how to bullshit. You know what it is? When I got this role... I spent 3 months watching old films. That's basically all I did. And I wasn't really watching it to learn about the time period or learn about any of that. I kind of let the writers take care of all that. I just wanted to figure out how people talked. Because you know what, man? People don't talk the same every generation. Right. You know, you go back to the 30s and the 20s, and people talk different than they did at the turn of the century and that they did in the 60s. And, you know... We go through different patterns of speech. We use different words. We literally have the way I'm sitting now is not the way men sat in the 60s. You would never see men maybe the beatniks would in the 1940s, but you and maybe the hippies would, but you would never see a business guy sitting like this, you know, hunched over. You know, there was a way that you behaved, and I learned that from watching these things. And there was a certain cadence to the voice, a certain richness. They cared about it. It mattered a little bit more. It was just different. And you know, it's not always the same because people in movies talk a little bit different than people in real life, but they do mimic each other. I mean, if you watch The Office or a modern-day TV show or film, you know, that's pretty similar to the way that people talk because we copy the people on the screen and the screen's copying people in the real world. And so I did a lot of that. And then... I borrowed from my grandpa a little bit. But I didn't do a lot of learning. I did a little bit about advertising, a tiny bit of learning about advertising, read a few books.
But Pete has definitely a distinctive way of talking. Mm-hmm. Was that something, once you brought that in and said, this is what I'm putting on the table to play this character, they were on board with that? Or
yes.
Did you really have to sell this thing? Like, no, I really feel like this is Pete's voice.
They were on board. I brought a little bit of it in the audition, like a tiny bit of it in the audition. And you'll see from the pilot on, it's gotten stronger. Like, if you were to watch the pilot and then what, like a season from season three and then an episode from season five, you can see it's changed. Mm-hmm. And that's because I'm not a great actor. If I was a great actor, it would have been consistent, truly. And I wasn't able to do that. It was something that did grow as I worked on it more. But it was something I kind of brought into there. And then at times Matthew would come to me and say, okay, this is too strong, or I need more of that, or I need a little more consistency with this or that. And so it's not something that I've been perfect at. And it's something that it's been a collaboration with me and Matthew and the directors who work with me so closely on set. And even John Hamm this season, I had an episode and he came over and he goes, don't lose Pete's diction in this scene. You're slipping out of it a little bit. And so I need those reminders, and it's helpful to have people around who can keep you kind of in line.
You're talking about when John directed?
Yeah, Mr. Hammersticks, yes.
Can you talk a little bit about, that's the second time directing, talk a little bit about what it's like to be directed by John.
It's awful. He's so good at it. You're just like, just be bad at something. Like, are you good at, do you want to go, I'm going to go shoot some bow and arrow this weekend. You want to come? I've never done that. Yeah, come with. And then he shows up and he's like, bullseye. I'm like, fuck you. Let's go sewing. Perfect cross stitch. Fuck you. Hang gliding, motherfucker. Yeah, he's perfect. and I love him for it. I love him. No, he's great. He's just like he is in real life. He's succinct. He gives you a really simple note. It's really short, which is nice. Some people, film, stage, doesn't matter what type of director, sometimes they give you the point and then they just keep on talking. He doesn't. He just comes up and he's like, hey, think about it before you say it. Let it occur to you. And he's out. It's like, that's all I need. Perfect. And that's nice. And he thinks about the shots. He's on set early. And, I mean, the guy's got a lot of heavy lifting to do actor-wise. You know? So it's a lot of work for him. He has to come in the week before for prep while he's still shooting as Don Draper. Then he has to shoot it while he's still being Don Draper. Then he has to edit it while he's still being Don Draper. You know? And that's a big load.
Is this something that you've ever thought about doing yourself?
No.
Never?
Not on Mad Men. I'm not ready. I don't have that. I'm not ready for that. I wouldn't be good. I'm not ready.
What have you? What are you thinking about doing in this upcoming hiatus that's coming up?
Anything on the horizon, work-wise? You got any offers for me yet?
I'm working on it.
Yeah, we're working on it. No, presently I am going to help out on my mom's daycare for a few weeks.
I can see you being good around kids, for sure.
You're being funny, right? I'm actually really good with kids, asshole. No, it's funny because no one would think that, right? You look at me and you're like, that's kind of weird.
I can see you being good with kids.
But I had a scene last season with these two, this kid, which is a twin, because you need, and everyone was shocked that like the kid was crying a lot, and then it got into my arms, and the kid was like, calm. I'm surprisingly a good caretaker of children.
If you could take a role in a different decade, era, period, what time would you like?
It's a good question. I'd like to play something in like the I never know how to say it. It's like the 19 teens. How would you say that? Like the 19-teens, like the 9-10 to 9...
The
10s? The 9-10s, right? Like, how do you... 19-10s? How do you say it? It's the hardest. That's the hardest era to be in because you don't know how to say it.
Well, don't pick it.
Yeah, right? Fuck it. No, the 20s. I want to be... No, but everyone does the 20s because they were the roaring 20s. And now, like, 20s or 30s would be fun, too, because then you could do that whole, like... Radio talkie voice. You know, everyone talk real fast like that, like guys and dolls. Yeah. See this guy here, Mr. Wise Guy. I don't know, something like that. Or I'd like to do like a real period piece, like 1800s or something. I don't know. It'll never happen. I'm never gonna work again.
Oh, with that attitude, Mister.
I've had this attitude my entire career. It's funny because I have all these friends who are like positive thinkers. And all like, things are going to be great. You'll see. I'm going to change the world. This next pilot season, I'm going to book the greatest pilot ever. They've been unemployed for decades. And I'm always like, it's over. I'm never going to fucking work again. Who would ever hire a shitty actor like, oh, we got nominated again? We won't win. Oh, we won. It won't last.
You say things have been very serendipitous for you, though, so it seems to be working out, right?
I don't know if those two thoughts are... I don't know how you got from one to the other. Yeah, answer me that. Does anyone else get that connection? Serendipity and negativity?
Well, yeah, because, I mean...
Because my negativity has added to my serendipitousness?
No, it's just that it just seemed to happen for you when you have these positive thinkers who seem to be really...
Yeah, I don't think one actually affects the other, though. I don't think negativity or positivity affects it. It's just like, it doesn't matter what you think. Just try your hardest and get lucky. I mean, being an actor is like winning the lottery. You know, it's like, at least maybe not in theater because there's a lot more jobs and has a lot less to do with other elements. It's kind of just about the performance. But yeah, in TV and film, it's really about winning the lottery. I mean, you have to have a ticket, you know, you have to have like some talent, but there's a lot of talented people on Skid Row. It's not really about your talent. It's right time, right place, right face. So I recognize that.
And a good shit.
What's that?
And having a good shit.
Have a good shit. Most regular guy you'll ever meet.
There you go. Thank you.
What I have to say, I really appreciate your honesty and this interview. I really do.
It's going to be the end of my career. I can see it now. Vincent Shittizer.